Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls, or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at Remarkable.com today.
Women to Watch is an intimate look into the lives of prominent and influential women leaders from around the world and the challenges they faced on their journey. It's the real story behind her title. Join us every week to hear more stories about women from around the world and in your own communities at womentowatch.net. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another week of Women to Watch. I'm Sue Rocco. Thanks so much for being with me. Joining me in just a moment will be Katie Gore. And Katie is the president of Quadel, which is a national affordable housing consultancy and training company. Katie has a remarkable story of growing up homeless at one point and then ending up serving the homeless and people that are trying to get into a home. So she has a really interesting and remarkable story. Don't forget to stay with us during the breaks, where you'll hear from our exclusive watch team of corporate partners. And please be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel at W2W Media. So now let's welcome to the show Katie Gore. Katie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. I wanted to start this interview off with a quote, because I think it very much tells the story of your beginning and kind of connects those dots to the work that you're doing today. So you said, growing up, I moved from one bad rental to another, often in short spurts and often on the wrong side of the tracks. So when Affordable Housing News recognized me as one of their power women, I realized this is much more than a professional honor. It's personal. Tell our viewers a little bit about life for you growing up in a small town in Indiana in the 70s.
Yes. You know, it's been an interesting dynamic because I grew up in an unusual, unstable family life. And I'm just now learning to understand how to describe some of what happened to me. Professionally, I was one who didn't have pictures of my family at my office desk. And so I'm just now understanding the dynamics here of sharing in this kind of a forum. So this is unusual. I'm learning. And but growing up, my family encountered a divorce that was quite messy and ugly. And then it thrust us into a poverty cycle, which created all kinds of ripple effects. I mean, moving from bad rental to bad rental, moving to really bad parts of town. I think I was jumped in third grade in a fight.
Oh my
God. Uber kids. I mean, it was rough in the streets. But there was also this dynamic that lack of food, lack of stability, lack of health care. So the instable home was also met with unstable housing, but it was creeping into all of these different other parts of my life as well.
By the way, you were the oldest of four children, and I know that, you know, as the oldest, you stepped up and often were helping to take care of your siblings, and that's a huge responsibility to take on.
It is. And when my parents divorced, you know, he kind of skipped out of state, skipped out with child support, skipped out of responsibilities. And my mom had a college degree, but she had never worked. And so she was scrambling to meet, you know, just to try to make ends meet, which they were not meeting, but she was scrambling to just eke out some sustenance. And she was working three jobs. And so I, at a young age, was taking care of my siblings, which at the time was just what we had to do. And it was an interesting dynamic because I was a kid myself trying to parent my siblings. Now the upside is we're all so very close today and we're all so very close with our kids. So there is an upside to having to go through such traumatic upbringings. And even at one point, we were homeless, and there was a stint of time where we were in a tent, and very, very traumatic for me as an oldest because I knew what was going on.
Whereas How old were you?
I think I was about 11 or 12, and my brother was just entering kindergarten, so he was about, you know, 5 or 6 years old. He just thought he was on a camping adventure for months and months at a time. But I was old enough to know what was going on and then would be there in the tent when my mom was working. So it was rough. It was very rough. Yeah.
You know, that is very difficult. And I think there were probably two things going on for you. There had to be some fear. And then you speak about, you know, your mom and the respect and the admiration you have for her holding down three jobs and taking care of four children in the very best way she could. Yeah. So tell me, what was your relationship with her at that time?
I think it was rocky because I didn't understand what was happening with the marriage. I resented the fact they couldn't make it work. And I really kept thinking, you know, even I remember being in the tent thinking, Dad's going to come down this road and save us any minute now. This is all going to turn around. And of course, that never happened. So I was stuck with the resentment of both parents, actually, because I felt like she was trying to do the best she could, but I knew it wasn't good enough. And yet I resented him too, because I felt like, why aren't you coming for us and taking care of us? And it was an interesting dynamic. It wasn't until I got into college, actually, that I realized how hard she had been trying to keep it all together.
Mm. It's always so interesting as we become adults and we reflect back. It is a very different picture.
Yeah.
And when you, did you have times of comparing yourself to your friends and students in school that were living different lives?
Yeah. The poverty stigma is very difficult for kids when you know that your lunch isn't the same, your clothes aren't the same. We couldn't get our report cards because the tuition bill wasn't paid. And they would announce our names in the class and pass out the report cards. Again, this was, you know, pre-Google. This was pre-online systems. Yeah. They had the old grade card, the old report card, and they would say everybody's name, but if you didn't have your accounts paid up, your lunch account paid up, your tuition accounts paid up, you didn't get your report card. And so I would sit there not knowing what it was.
Yeah.
So we knew what the poverty stigma was. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, Katie, the impressive thing is where you have come, how far you've come in spite of a beginning like that. And I know one of the things that you're most proud of is getting to college, making it through college, and contributing financially. How did you do that?
You know, I thought there was only one way for me to get out of that poverty and stay out of the poverty and then not let that repeat for my own family that I wanted to have. And I said, I've got to get to college because I don't have any other way to make that happen for me. You know, I saw what my mom was trying to hobble together. And I said, I've got to do something else that gets me to another point. So it was that desperation. And I applied for colleges and didn't get in. I didn't have all of the standardized test scores that you had to have. And so I applied for colleges that said, just give me a chance, just get me in the door. And I found a college that actually my mom had gone to and managed to get in. And at that point, there were a lot of federal assistance for income related, kids. There was still a gap. And so I was working a full-time job and going to college full-time and paying for my own school. And I remember one time going into the financial counselor's office and saying, hey, there's still a gap. I can't get a loan. You know, what do I do? And they said, you need to step out of college and sit out for a year and come back if you can. And I left that counselor's office just devastated. And I said, you should have been, in my mind, I'm like, you should have been helping me with the solution. You should have been trying to help me figure out how to fill the gaps and basically told me to get out. I realized that if this was going to happen, I was going to have to do it on my own. Mm. Just like everything else that had occurred in life.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to do this on my own. And so that's when I picked up another job while going to school full time and started paying my own tuition. And it was a unique eye-opening experience because it actually led me to the next career step and getting my master's and kind of like it just kind of kept pushing me along in the education pipeline, if you will.
Yeah. Where were you living at the time? Were you on campus?
I was on campus. And then shortly after that, I moved into a place that was $300 a month that I split with two other people. It was very, very tiny.
Well, but that's very affordable, right?
That's what we could afford, correct?
Yeah. Katie, was there anybody in your life, an adult, that kind of stepped in and supported and guided you that, you know, just helped you with your confidence and self-belief?
Well, it's interesting because you always remember the doubters who tell you no. But we did have people who were feeding into our family, both literally and figuratively. I mean, there were times that we actually had no food. And my mom was too proud to accept food stamps, which, you know, is a whole nother conversation. But she felt guilty and ashamed of getting food stamps. So we didn't have access to that. But there were times when people would just show up with groceries and knew that we were eating rice and canned tuna and passed around government cheese. And they would show up with what we would call real food when it would come. And there were people along the way that were recognizing our struggles and helping us out in those moments. And even transitioning from the tent to an apartment, it was a one bedroom apartment and all five of us slept in the one bedroom apartment. And the lady who owned that apartment was a single lady herself. And she said, I've got a garage converted apartment. It's not much, but you guys can now move into it. We thought we had hit the jackpot to move into this tiny little apartment. But it was her kindness to say, it's not much, but it's going to help you stabilize. So there were people along the way that were trying with what they could do to help us.
Yeah. I would imagine having less to that extent growing up would make you so much more grateful for little things And has that carried, you know, with you through life, even as you've become successful and been able to provide much more for yourself?
It has. Gratitude is also one of the things of resiliency. Mm-hmm. People who have a lot of grit to grow up with whatever their journey is, there is a common denominator that grit and gratitude seems to follow us when we've lived through this. Even when my kids were young, I have five kids now, and when they were young, we would do meal planning, and we would sort of incorporate scarcity, but not the scarcity that I had experienced, but just the appreciation, you know, for what you eat is what's in front of you. And so I actually found tips that I carried over into my parenting, but I made them healthy. I made them based upon some normalcy instead of, you know, those dire types of situation. And you're right, gratitude was one of those things. And one of the things I did when I was in college, they had a program that you could do community service, volunteer service, both in country and out of country. And I found that feeding my soul was helping me process what circumstances I had been through. And so I signed up for these programs where I would go and help serve, whether it was for, migrant food shelters, or whether it was for, Sunday school, or, you know, kids building a roof on a building. And, you know, like all of these types of things, it actually helped me go into some other extreme poverty countries and neighborhoods. And I learned so much about seeing other people in similar and worse conditions, actually. Mm-hmm. That fed my soul in a different way. And I think that also speaks to some of the gratitude as well.
Yeah. Yes, it must have felt as though you were helping others, but you were helping that little girl that was you that was in that place,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
You mentioned your children. I was going to talk about them a little bit later, but you know, another incredibly impressive thing about you, Katie, is that you have five children and two have disabilities.
Yep.
So that in itself is a major challenge, because it's challenging emotionally and mm-hmm. it's challenging physically and just with all the other things you have to do. Tell me about your kids. And tell me, you know, as you've risen through this industry over 30 years, I don't want to say how did you juggle or manage, but what was your secret for keeping it together, right? And splitting your time between your professional and your personal life?
So the five kids, I mean, whether you have one kid or five kids, kids are a handful.
Five's a lot harder than one.
Yeah. There are no tricks and trades, and every single kid is so different as far as energy that you need to mobilize around them, their lives, their needs. So there is really no tricks and trades. I drink a lot of caffeine.
Thank God for coffee.
I know. but I would say I've always been a working mother. And, you know, I was wearing maternity suits and maternity pantyhose, way back decades ago. So I've just always known that as far as, you know, having to balance work and life. I used to be really, really strict about keeping them divided, you know, not talking about a lot of personal things. And I think women are learning that we don't have to be. But when I, you know, 30 years ago, when I was entering the workforce, we really had to protect ourselves. We couldn't, you know, talk about too much about being a mother. We couldn't talk too much about raising kids, what it was like, both the rewards and the frustrations. We're just now learning, I think, or I'm just now learning that we can. And that's actually what makes
Absolutely.
Us really organized. It's what makes us uber efficient.
Yes.
And it actually drives us. Having kids and being a working mom is something that a lot of people do. And we just do what's needed. I mean, we just make it happen. And some days it's fantastic and we're nailing it. And other days we are just crawling around on our hands and knees, trying to make things work. But I don't have a nanny, so I don't have a lot of supports that people have who, I remember reading the Lean In book, and I remember saying, well, that's just great because you have a cook and you have a nanny and you have a transportation person, but for the common person, like, what can we do? And I had to create my own reality of what can I do? And we had to look at, you know, how we're going to manage kids and how we're going to divide up roles. And like, I don't do any of the laundry. My husband does all the laundry. And we had to come up with non-gender specific roles because there was no way I can do what I needed to do and be the best I could be if we stuck in some traditional gender role. And I have a very progressive and understanding spouse who realized that too. So that was one thing, as we set all those, you know, biases about gender roles aside, and we said, what are you good at? What am I good at? How can we make this work? And then when I had my fourth child with special needs, we kind of like crumpled up that paper and created a new pad.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, you seem to have a wonderful attitude about life. And I would say, you know, being practical and doing what's necessary is sometimes right, all that you can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there are days that you just sit there and go, what am I doing? And why am I doing this? But if you can figure out why you're doing these things, and you know that both personally and professionally, what is my driver? Like, I don't want to raise my kids in poverty. I've been there. I've done that. And I don't want to raise them in poverty. And, you know, that was my personal reason for my drive. Professionally, I just happened to be working in an industry that, you know, call it fate, call it divine, whatever reason. But I happen to be working in an industry that works to help people get access to affordable housing and prevent homelessness. So it is a unique blend of where I've been to what I'm doing. So I understand perfectly what my personal and professional whys are.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's always one of my questions, you know, what is it that's driving you? And you just answered that question perfectly. And we're going to go into our first break. When we come back, I want to talk more about the work and how you initially landed in the industry of affordable housing. Stay with us as we go into our break. You'll hear from our watch team of ongoing contributors, and we'll be back with Katie Gore.
Hi, my name is Christy McCaffrey. I'm the founder and owner of Be The Good Media, and I'm here to share some good news with you. Today, I wanted to share with you about a woman who is truly doing meaningful and impact-driven work in her community. Her name is Corinne O'Connell. Corinne is the CEO of Habitat for Humanity Philadelphia. And as CEO, Corinne and her team work to make sure that every person in our city has a decent place to live. I was truly inspired in speaking with Corinne on my show because it was just so clear how passionate she is about making a meaningful impact in her community and in the lives of those she serves, not just today, but for many more years to come. You can hear more of my conversation with Corinne at BeTheGoodMedia.com, and there you will also learn more about how Be The Good Media helps to amplify impact-driven missions and causes. Again, I'm Christy McCaffrey. Stay tuned here on Women to Watch Media for more good news.
Ladies, I'm Tiffany Curtin, a financial professional with more than 25 years of experience serving successful women, families, and businesses. Here's the reality. You don't have to be the one managing your family's finances to take ownership of your future. But if you want true confidence about how everything is going to play out, you do have to take part in the process. That doesn't mean digging into the weeds of your finances when you don't have the time or desire. It means elevating your awareness of your own circumstances. It means having the bigger conversations so you're empowered when you need to be. Let's bring confidence to your family's future without overwhelming your time. Call myself at
Your Check, Your Cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
903-520-2709. That's 903-520-2709. Or visit Johnson Financial Group on our website, www.jfg.cc. Not .com, www.jfg.cc.
Hi, I'm Dawn Zier, CEO, board director, and executive mentor to Fortune 500 executives through my work at the EXCO Group, firm of experienced CEOs, board directors, and global business leaders who offer real-world experience to help organizations and senior leaders grow. Today on Leadership Watch, we're going to talk about being in the driver's seat of your career. No matter what stage you're at in your career, you need to grasp that you are in the driver's seat. Understanding from day one that you and you alone are responsible for your career is critical. After all, why would you hand your career over to someone else to manage? There's no one as vested in yourself as you. And the ugly truth is that most managers are focused on execution rather than team development. So how can you ensure that your career stays on track? First, make sure you have a clear set of agreed upon goals that are measurable, and if priorities shift, rewrite them with buy-in. Two, if you see something that can be improved upon or automated, don't wait to be asked, just do it. This is good advice for tech-savvy millennials and Gen Zs who can help lead the way with AI. Three, don't insulate yourself. Get to know other parts of the organization and network both internally and externally. Feel free to drive outside of your lane. And four, while your career is yours to own, don't go it alone. Identify sponsors and mentors. Also, it's important to make self-reflection and self-assessment a habit. Think through where you want to be 5 years from now and create a roadmap for yourself. Does your current path get you there? Are you passionate about what you're doing? Do you feel challenged? Are you learning? Do you feel respected? And importantly, are you a cultural fit? And is the company a cultural fit for you? If you answer negative to any of these questions, it's likely time for some course correcting. Please follow me on LinkedIn at Dawn Zier. And if you're a senior executive looking to grow in your career, check out expoleadership.com to learn more.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the show. I'm joined this week by Katie Gore, and Katie is the president of Quadel, which is an affordable housing consultancy and training firm, company. I'm not sure which is more appropriate, but so I get my first question is, how did you fall into the field? What was that first opportunity?
So, you know, it's a good question because I think once people are reach a certain level, whether tenure, success, you know, duration, whatever those levels are, people always want to go, who are you and how did you do it? And it's not as simple as that. But when I went to college, then I went out and got my master's. And quite honestly, I took the first job I could get. After I got my master's, I was like, I'll take anything, I'll do it. And I took a financial analyst role working for a city that had a lot of HUD and housing money. And I was like, I'm a policy person. I'm a political science major. Sure, I'll take a finance job.
They hired you.
They hired me. And I did that for a while. And then I started after that. They moved us over to the housing authority to help them. They were trying to avoid trouble status. And that's really where I started to kind of get my housing chops, if you will, working for the housing authority. And from there, I've been doing that for 3 decades now. And it's not something that I said, oh, here's my 5-year goal. Oh, here's my 10-year goal. But once I got into it, I absolutely was so aligned with what the industry was trying to accomplish.
Yeah. You just must have connected on, you know, mm-hmm. a deeper level with all of it. I'm so interested in, you know, if we look at housing today, my gosh, there's so much going on. And having been in it for 30 years, we just look at even the housing market today for regular people, not even people that are necessarily struggling financially. And I don't know that it's ever been like this. How does the actual housing market, if at all, affect the work that you're doing? You know, real estate, the fact that young people are really struggling to get a house.
Yeah, good question. It is the access to supply right now is some of the hardest it's been. And this just general supply, you know, not even just when I talk about what's affordable or what's prorated for people's income. Right now, there's just a real big supply pinch. At the same time, so we're saying like there's not a lot of places out there available. At the same time where you have a lot of people, the demand is really, really great. So we have an unusual dynamic right now. We haven't been building as many affordable housing apartments, a regular single family. Like, so there's some dynamics that we're at that dangerous intersection of what's happening. And what we do is, you know, we'll help housing authorities specifically or private owners and managers help people to get in and be qualified. We also help them with consulting and technical assistance, but we're seeing people, you know, sometimes there's 20,000 people on a waiting list to try to get a Section 8 voucher, for example, or a housing choice voucher, whatever lingo you want to use. And those used to be like, you know, the big lottery ticket. Like I got a voucher, you know, I can have affordable housing and I can find a rental. Now we see people turning them back because they can't find a rental. And it's really an unusual dynamic that used to just be for the big cities, so to speak. But now we're seeing this all across America right now.
As someone completely unknowledgeable about it, we look at what happened after COVID and all of the real estate that was left empty.
Yeah.
Are they utilizing those spaces, those buildings for housing?
There are developers and there are cities who are now taking commercial space and converting it. And that would never have been a dynamic before COVID. And now we're seeing as the market has shifted, people are now willing to go in and try to retrofit some of those buildings. We're also seeing people be more agreeable to what they call tiny homes or homes that are, you know, maybe 1,000 square foot that are $80,000 that are just kind of unfolded. Whereas people just really dismissed a lot of those innovative concepts. But now, out of desperation, there are so many of those models that are on the table right now.
I would say even people that can afford a lot are kind of looking at the big giant house they built and lived in as kind of silly and unnecessary.
Yeah.
And they're looking to downsize. So who are your clients exactly?
Good question. Public housing authorities and a lot of owners and agents of affordable housing, whether it is like a one house or a multifamily, big apartment community. For housing authorities, we really have a niche. I think of us kind of like the house flippers. We really have a niche going into a housing authority with that before and after picture. It needs a little bit of fixing up. and we help flip them to a more compliant, higher leased, more efficient scenario. So that's what we do a lot. And it makes sense because you have people who are trying to get housing and they want this process to be efficient. You want housing authorities to lease as many people as they possibly can and that they're budgeted for. So we go in and help make sure they can do that.
This is probably a big question, but because of the work that you do, I want to ask you your take on the homeless situation here in our country. Mm-hmm. It's so prevalent. It's so much everywhere. Yeah. And it's so much more than, it's more about just money, right? Mm-hmm. There's circumstances, mm-hmm. there's beginnings for these people and why they are where they are. Do you have thoughts on how we can, as a country, improve the situation?
So this is tricky because I was homeless for a while and we did not choose to be homeless, but it was the only option we had, especially as a child. Like, I didn't choose that. I didn't deserve that, but it's where we were. And in our case, we didn't have complicators like, substance abuse, which is another complicator to a larger conversation. But solutions are there. And there are cities who are doing a great job in identifying shelters, identifying short-term rentals, identifying supportive structures to help address the needs, whatever those needs are. But what I'm finding is we can't judge the person as to why they're there. We can't say, you need to get your stuff together before we help you to the next level. We actually need to focus on the housing first, stability, and then we're able to wrap around and say, okay, now what do we need? Is it healthcare? Is it dental care? Is it food stability? Is it reunification with your kids? Is it whatever? And so this is an interesting debate that we're having, is to say, do we house the person first and then fold in the services? Or do we say, okay, they've got so many ancillary needs, try to get those fixed, and then they're eligible for housing? And this is a national debate that's happening right now. It's very complicated. It really is. Very complicated. Yes.
It's very complicated. Mm-hmm. I agree. And mental illness is a whole other topic aside from, as you like, a situation from yours, it really strictly was about finances. Mm-hmm. So, but that is the biggest question, you know, what to do first to help help these people and have it sustained for them and have them then be able to feel that they have a life of purpose for themselves. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we could talk a whole nother show about that.
Yeah.
Tell me, what are you most hopeful for in the work that you're doing? And of course, this is a political time. We're going to have a whole new administration one way or the other. What are you most hopeful for?
I'm hopeful because it's a really good question. Not a lot of people ask me this. So I'm off the top of my head here, but I'm hopeful that more people are talking about affordable housing. Like, it's not been in the forefront of a conversation. And with the economy right now, with what everybody went through, with rent stabilization, and it's now part of a conversation that not just those of us in housing have been having. More people have been talking about this, which to me, I feels like there's, okay, so now we're going to have more conversations to lead to more solutions. And now we can start developing, what is it we want to do? Do we want to say, hey, as a nation, we commit to this many new units? Do we want to say, no, we're going to offer this many tax credits so private developers can come in and be incentivized to build? Or we're going to fully fund housing authorities to do the job we task them with? And so I'm hopeful that more people are talking about this, mm-hmm. which gives me hope that a solution can be drafted and redrafted and implemented.
Yeah. And these conversations need to be had without all of the emotion behind it, right? Mm-hmm. It needs to be solution oriented and, what actionable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And there are so many people who used to be opposed to apartments or zoning problems. And there was a lot of tension, and in a lot of communities that still exist. But with more people saying, yes, I get it. I can't afford $3,000 a month, or I can't afford $3,500. More people are now coming in and saying, okay, let's readjust those assumptions we had about what we build and where we build it and what it looks like and for who we are doing this for. Because the assumptions were way off on who needs affordable housing.
Well, perhaps you'll be able to bring more awareness at some point on a regular basis. And I think you're right. It's always being educated and more knowledgeable about a topic is always a great first place to start, mm-hmm. to move towards things being done.
Yeah. And it's a learning process. It's like everything else. But the dire need is that we have people who are making wages who can't afford rent. And 50% of your wages shouldn't go to your rent. And this is a dynamic that everybody is experiencing. So, it affects worker housing, veteran housing, senior housing, disabled housing. Like, there's so many populations that are impacted by this. It's not really what maybe my grandparents used to say, like, oh, it's a low income problem. You know, that's no longer. We've changed who is impacted by all of this now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the veterans. Yes. I guess you do a lot of work with the veterans.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they're certainly deserving.
Yeah. And there's, you know, again, we talked about there's a whole nother dynamic when you're housing veterans and what their needs are and what they view stability and how they want services and how they want connectivity. I actually did a really interesting podcast that I have, and we interviewed some organizations that specialize in housing homeless veterans, which I think is like how we have homeless veterans, right? Like, what?
Yes, right.
Yes. And I mean, it's the same thing why we have homeless families. Like, this should be an absolute no. But I have a podcast who have interviewed specific organizations that address homeless veterans. And it's just odd that we're even having conversations like that.
Yeah, that's something too. I think it's being spoken so much more about openly and loudly that mm-hmm. people are saying that should not ever be the case. So
yeah,
I think we'll see change there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Katie, I'm so grateful that you took some time to be on the show, and your life is really remarkable and impressive. And I think you're very humble. I don't know that you realize how far you've come.
Thank you very much. I've had people actually say to me when they get to know me, they're like, I thought you were from a two-income family, easy peasy street with the picket fence. And I'm like, oh, have a chair.
I'm sure you have stories. Yeah. Thank and you. It's good to look back and see it for what it is. And now, you know, as an adult, appreciate where you are. So I thank you so much, and we'll be in touch for sure.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for this platform. I appreciate what you're doing.
Thank you. Stay with us as we go into our last break, and I'll be back to close out the show.
Children's Hospital of Philadelphia has long been ranked as one of the best children's hospitals in the country. In our Women to Watch at CHOP series, we'll meet the women working to preserve this best-in-class pediatric innovation. Let's meet Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer, Sophia Holder. Sophia, just take a minute to kind of introduce yourself to our guests. Tell them a little bit about where you came from and how you ended up in this role.
Yes, and thank you, Susan, for just the amazing work that you do to inspire women leadership. I would still call myself as new to CHOP, started just over 3 years ago, and I'm honestly in my dream job in an organization that is focused on delivering and innovating care for children. And so it's hard not to find joy in that space. My career in healthcare spans many years, starting in the adult side and now on the pediatric side. And I'm just really thrilled to be with you today.
What advice would you have for our listeners and our viewers listening to you today?
So I would offer two pieces of advice. Focus on continuous learning. Be a life learner. That's the frame that I often use with those who work with me and for me. Stay updated on industry trends. Continuously seek opportunities for learning and growth. Knowledge is power in any leadership role. I think the other piece of advice that I would give is model authenticity. Be authentic and true to yourself. Authentic leadership builds trust and loyalty among your team and your peers, foundational to building effective teams and supporting cross-collaboration and partnership.
Thanks so much to Sophia Holder for joining us. Stay tuned for more Women to Watch at CHOP.
We are CHOP, and we can't wait to show you around. We're the nation's first children's hospital. Now, a care network with more than 50 locations that continues to expand. Three state-of-the-art research buildings with 1.5 million square feet of space. We have grown from 12 beds 165 years ago to nearly 600 beds and one of the best children's hospitals in the world. We have a level one trauma center, 11 floors of patient units, more than 20 operating rooms, first of its kind delivery unit for babies with birth defects, a separate cardiac operative and catheterization suite, and places to learn, like our internationally recognized simulation center. We have trained generations of leaders in the field of pediatrics. We are world leaders in medicine, surgery, and science. One of the top recipients in NIH funding for pediatric research. In this building, pioneers in CAR T therapy, mitochondrial disease, brain tumors, hyperinsulinism, and other rare diseases. Here, groundbreaking work in fetal surgery, genetics and genomics, and neurology. In our newest building, leaders in social determinants of health, clinical informatics and epidemiology, autism, trauma and injury prevention. Our patients come from every state and 115 countries. Meeting these challenges requires the best and the brightest. We are passionate about pediatrics. We are motivated to make a difference in the world and in our community. We are a team. We are CHOP.
That's it, everyone, for another week of Women to Watch. Thanks for tuning in. Next week, I'll be speaking with Elam Chinorik, and Elam is the founder of Women on Stage. Thanks, as always, to our Watch team of corporate partners. And if you're a fan of the show, we do have some wonderful sponsorship and advertising opportunities available. So if you're a woman looking for media exposure and you'd like to learn more, feel free to reach out to me directly at susan@womentowatch.net. Have a great week, everyone.